Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. As this extraordinary year draws to a close and our roundtable joins us to look back at 2020, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as well as what may have been inspirational and whatnot, joining us to discuss the week and indeed the year are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute Think Tank, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many hats is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Vago.
Great to be here.
Thank you, Vago.
Good to be back.
Always an honor and pleasure, guys. Thanks very much for squeezing us in on this early show, given that Christmas does fall on a Friday and we thought we'd give everybody a break. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Michael, first, as a son of New Jersey, congratulations. I'm sure you're ecstatic that the boss, Bruce Springsteen, got elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I know that looms large in your mind. But I think you're somewhat less happy about President Trump's move to veto the stimulus package. Casting the work of thousands of people over the past many months. He obviously has called the nearly $900 billion package a disgrace, wants $2,000 in benefits for the unemployed rather than $600. But this is much, much more than the stimulus package. Sort of start us off before we get to a year in review on some of the fundamentals here and the potential implications, because this thing then hops the rail, and not just this, but the National Defense Authorization Act and even the omnibus measure that's supposed to keep the government open.
Exactly. There's three big deals that, impact the national security environment. And Trump, the great deal maker, is ready to blow up all three of them with 8 days left to go in the year. First, today is the deadline for him to veto the National Defense Authorization Act. He's scheduled to fly out to Mar-a-Lago this afternoon, so everybody's watching the clock to see if he does it. In the meantime, Senator McConnell went to the Senate floor to praise the NDAA this week, and Senator Inhofe has been tweeting almost daily in support of the NDAA. So now, on last time we spoke, we were passing a short-term CR to get the omnibus appropriations bill done, along with the COVID relief package. Another short-term CR had to be passed in order to give them time to wrap things up on Monday. But they did, after 8 months, came to an agreement, and within a 10-hour time frame, passed both the House and the Senate. The bill is enormous. It's over 6,000 pages long. So as a result, Congress had to pass another continuing resolution on Monday that runs out the following Monday on the 28th to give Congress time to what's called enroll the bill. So they have to go through it, find mistakes, print out the bill, put it on nice paper, get McConnell to sign it, Pelosi to sign it, and send it to the president. Now, we all know there's a lot of great things in this package. We don't need to go through them all, but one of the key things in here is the direct payments to individuals of $600. And for the defense community, the extensions of 3610 of the CARES Act that allows defense contractors to keep employees on the payroll even if these federal facilities close. Now, there's a great backstory to how this deal came together, but it's all being overshadowed now by the president threatening to veto the bill. And by vetoing the coronavirus relief package, he'd also be vetoing the omnibus, which puts a government shutdown in play and puts in play everything that everybody's worked with for the entire year. And it puts in some obscure constitutional provisions in play, because we're coming to the end of the Congress, and the president actually could exercise what's called a pocket veto on the bill. So since the bill is so large and is not finished being enrolled and delivered to the president, there's a 10-day window under Article 1, Section 7 of the Constitution. So if the president doesn't do anything and Congress adjourns, the bill is pocket vetoed. And right now, that time frame would pass, because the old Congress would have to adjourn before midnight on January 2nd. And I mentioned these payments to individuals because that's one of the things the president is upset about. He's now saying he would like to see $2,000 payments to individuals and $4,000 per couple, even though the $600 number is what came from Mnuchin.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing that irritates everybody in this process at this point, is that the president has been pretty much not a player in these conversations. And after months of negotiations, is suddenly inserting himself in it. I mean, if he had any questions, problems, or issues, he should have been dealing with his Treasury Secretary that was the interlocutor for the administration with both the House and the Senate.
Absolutely. The president has just been engulfed in this fantasy that there's been election fraud and he's going to be president again next year. Even in the video that he released last night threatening to veto the bill, he talks about the possibility that he will be president next year and have to do a relief package next year. His aides are stunned by this because they were publicly praising the bill. The media was expecting him to sign the bill rapidly. So last night I was texting with both Democrat and Republican leaders last night, scrambling to figure out the implications of this and where this is headed and whether the president is bluffing or not bluffing. So, his presidency is ending as it began in total chaos.
Very quickly, do things get easier early next year or do they get harder, right, as we go into the new Congress?
Frankly, I think they get harder. I think the Congress will be very closely divided. Even if the Democrats pick up the seats in Georgia, we'll have a 50-50 Senate. Democrats will have a 5-seat majority in the House. The Democrats need to worry about the progressives. The Republicans need to worry about the Trumpians that are still going to be there. Even if this relief package does pass, many of the authorities expire in March. And Biden's already put down a marker that he's going to want another relief package or a recovery package early on in his presidency. And, I think he's going to come up to a wall of opposition from Republicans, mostly based on the spending, because I think, as we've discussed in previous podcasts, I think Republicans will rediscover their fiscal responsibility again and will want to oppose more spending.
As we obviously heard from Rand Paul, made a great show of, hey, if we're handing out money, let's hand out free money to everybody. Why not $2,000? And apparently the president was thinking, yes, why not $2,000? Hey, why not $10,000? I want to now get into the 2020 review, although does anybody have any follow-up comment quickly on Michael before we move from current business to future business? Lovely.
The only thing I will say, Vago, is that it just appears that this president is determined to bring as much of the temple crashing down around his ears as he departs as he possibly can. And this threatened veto on the appropriations bill is only one example, attempting to destroy the civil services, another, the pardons, the oil leases in Alaska. There's just a whole series of things that he's ripping, slashing, and tearing on his way out the door.
And I think there are even concerns about whether or not military action in the Middle East, especially against Iran, may be in the offing as well to try to box a Biden administration in. Byron, let me start with you, right? Part of the charge that every organization has is to take a look back at the year. And this year, we're trying to do something a little bit more nuanced. What are the stories that should have been highlighted? Who are the people who should be lauded? Who should the people be who may be open to a little bit of criticism, right? What's your sense in sort of high points, low points, and especially stories that didn't get the coverage they deserved?
One of the high points, I think, is the Department of Defense is really pretty good about handling the pandemic and how it impacted contractors. I mean, you really didn't see stress and major disruptions in programs. Sure, they're fairly minor ones, but overall, if I had to hand out a candy cane, it would be to the Department of Defense for how they interacted and dealt with contractors in this. Now, I might also hand out I don't know if it's a lump of coal, but I think one of the things that I don't think is widely appreciated that's going to have a bearing on 2021 and beyond is the fact that a lot of these stocks of the largest defense contractors underperform the market. And that typically doesn't happen in a presidential election year. I think you're starting to see some muscle movement, the Northrop Grumman divestiture of part of their IT business. And then earlier this week, the announcement that Lockheed Martin intended to buy Aerojet Rocketdyne. I just think these managements are going to be under more pressure in 2021 to deliver a better stock price performance. And that's a story that I think is really going to start to ripple through how contractors behave, what they do with their portfolios, how aggressively they attend to defend core programs, and what they might think is less than core that might be divested and given to someone else who can take cash out of it or do something better with it. So those are my two candidates.
Gordon, what's your sense, right? I mean, obviously, for highlights of the year, I mean, we've talked coronavirus to death. We've talked President Trump's transgressions to death and as well discussed the budget and much more. But what are some of the things that jumped out as you at you? And then, Dove, get your sense as well of, you know, what was more important that maybe folks didn't focus on? And what were sort of high point moments and low point moments you guys think, both for people and for events?
Well, in terms of the big deals, if you will, the remarkable events of the year, I think beyond what we've already talked about, Biden COVID, I think there are three possibly that I would focus on. One is the resurgence of an awareness of racism in America, the Black Lives Matter movement, the responses to police violence that has put the whole question of race in America back on the table, and it deserves to be there. That's a big deal. Second, important, I think, really for everybody, and the next two are really security issues, but they're in disguise. One is, guess what? We need a government. After years and years and years of trying to dismantle and tear down the government, the fact that we've had nearly $3 trillion worth of bills just around COVID and stimulus is pretty amazing. We do need a government, and we're seeing in the difficulties we've faced over the last 8 or 10 months that government functioning is an important part of our society's functioning. And the third one is it goes back to 1992, if you will, it's the economy, stupid, that the internal and external challenge for the United States is the state of the American economy, its infrastructure, its technology, its investments, its workforce. All of those things are critically important, not only for the healthy functioning at home, but for being able to compete in the world. So that's the highlights. In terms of sort of lumps of coal first, maybe, the biggest lump of coal, or the biggest concern I have, is the damage to democracy done largely under the leadership of what's been a takeover of the Republican Party. And the real question for me is going to be how long the Republican Party is going to stay on the road of trying to damage the very essence of our democracy itself. That challenge has far from gone away. In terms of...
I should note that many people who don't know, you started your career some years of it, in fact, as a Republican before you became a Democrat.
I did indeed. And it's sorrowful to me to see what has happened to the Republican Party, and in a sense, shame on them. In terms of people who get a garland for what happened in the last year, I think the first real garland needs to go to the brave men and women, no, not of the armed forces, but in America's hospitals and grocery stores and parking lots and all of the things that continue to function through the most deadly contagion that we've ever seen in the history of the United States. God bless them. Second garland to the election workers, including the Republican election workers in places like Georgia, who did their job despite the effort to destroy democracy. And thirdly, I think I would give a garland right up to, but not necessarily including the current acting Secretary of Defense, to the Defense Department, who it seems to me showed immense patience over the last 4 years in trying to hold off some of the worst damage and maybe some of the worst interventions and uses of force that this administration might have done. So they clearly get a garland. I think that's basically how I would distribute my awards for 2020.
Dove?
Well, I don't disagree with any of it that's been said so far. So what I would want to do is add some, it's like the Oscars, they go on till 1 a.m. because you keep adding more and more. So I'm going to add some more Oscars. First of all, it's not just DOD that deserves a garland, but I think the civil service. I mean, to work under the conditions that these people have been working under for 4 years and trying to make the government work when the guy at the top is trying to make the government fail, they definitely deserve a garland. Inside DOD itself, I would give a garland to Ellen Lord. I don't know how she's managed to survive 4 years to try to deal with acquisition in a rational way. She's been able to protect some of the industrial base. She is forward thinking, and nobody writes about her very much. So I would give her a garland. I would also give a garland to the Armed Services Committees. They are bipartisan. Whatever else they may disagree about, they push through the legislation, the NDAA again, and if the president vetoes, they've got at least a 50-50 shot at overriding him. So I give them a garland as well. And finally, to the military for not carrying out the president's 2016 promise and getting out of everywhere. The fact of the matter is, he toyed with Korea, didn't happen. Afghanistan, there'll be a few thousand. We'll see what Biden does. There's still some in Iraq, and even in Somalia, now they're offshore, but they're still there. So I give them credit for dragging their heels for once when they should have dragged their heels. In terms of Coles, I don't think that the, oh, and one other person deserves credit. You know, full disclosure, he was my deputy at one point, but Deputy Secretary Norquist has been managing, Dave has been managing to keep the trains running in the Pentagon somehow. And again, I just don't know how he's managed to do it. But generally at the very top of the Pentagon, I mean, clearly this has been a chaotic year. And there's no other way to look at it. Whoever has been responsible, we know who really is responsible for all the changes in the various boards and commissions and the secretary himself and the various assistant secretaries and undersecretaries and everybody who gets canned all the time. Clearly the chaos at the top there is just something that is a massive coal, lump of coal. Executive orders. I'm very worried that Biden's going to be forced to govern by executive order again. This is not government. This is not the way the Constitution had it. Now, Gordon's right. I mean, Congress is a mess. The Republican Party's a mess. But whatever the reason, we cannot be governed by executive order because all that does is essentially tell the Trumps of this world, you know what, get elected president and you're really emperor, not even king. We've got to do something about that. Both parties have to do something about that. And hopefully, if they can, they've reached a couple of agreements, if they can reach a few more and Biden can withhold his own temptation, which his assistants will tell him to do, to issue one after another executive order, I think that'll be good for the country. And finally, one of the biggest coals going on right now is the extremism, and I would underscore on both sides. On the one hand, you've got the right wingers running around with their guns, threatening people's lives, applauding everything this president does. On the other hand, you've got the crazies out in Portland and other places who, in the name of Black Lives Matter, even though 99% of them don't seem to be Black from the videos I've seen, and the Black community takes it on the chin because of them, these people damaging windows, breaking into places, causing all kinds of trouble, they're just as extreme. They're doing it a different way. And this country needs to get back to the middle and leave these crazies on both sides way out at sea.
I think that the challenge on any of these things, and unfortunately, that's it's awful that people remember those instances, given that it was tens and tens of millions of people in the United States and around the world who were actually remarkably peacefully protesting. And so that's particularly bad that folks remember those elements, those that did destroy property, and somehow forgetting all of the other people who were, in fact, peacefully protesting. Michael, let me go to you.
They undermined the case. Let me just finish. And they undermined the case, the very strong, compelling case for dealing with racial injustice in this country. They hurt the case.
I believe that there was a backlash to that. Gordon, do you want to add anything to it? Because, I think that when people think back to the 1960s, the civil rights movement was at its height because it was such a peaceful movement in the face of violence. Right. I mean, was that something that you think was a mistake that backfired on the movement, characterizing it as burned out cities and broken glass and violence, as opposed to how we're trying to peacefully actually move the debate forward? I know everybody who was involved in it was continuously asking for calm and deference and peaceful protesting. Even the Floyd family, right? All the families who were affected by the violence that triggered the demonstrations constantly were urging peaceful protest.
Well, you know, for me, it's not really a useful debate, left, right, extreme, extreme. The real question is the one that Doug posed at the end, which may not be the center, But how do we get to a reasonable structure of discussion, debate, negotiation, compromise, and understanding in American governance? And I think we're a long way from it. And frankly, I attribute the large part of the responsibility for the assault on democracy that presents to what's happened to the party I once belonged to. It's the Republican Party that's a big part of the problem. And we're a long way from resolving that dispute at the heart of American politics. If you look at what we're going to confront in January, particularly if McConnell retains the two seats in Georgia, is it's going to be a war to the death between the Hill and the executive branch. And I despair for a return to civility in the way people actually conduct the business of government.
And I think for some of the people in the audience who might be wondering, why are they talking about this? This is an issue because race is unfortunately an issue in the military. One part of society that was regarded as potentially the most race blind. We have a study in the United States Air Force that makes abundantly clear that actually there are racial differences, impacts that race has on service that should be blind, and something that C.Q. Brown, the first African American to head the United States Air Force, in what I think was one of the most extraordinary and important and moving discussions of what it was like to be a Black airman, and the pressure that that put on him, and the importance and the symbolism of it, and what he's trying to accomplish. I think
that was very powerful. I agree, Vago. That was a stunningly good moment, that particular discourse. We still have a long way to go, even in the military services, because the ranks of people of color are very large at the lower ranks and the enlisted. They're not so diverse when you get into the officer corps. So there's still a lot of work to be done.
As an African-American friend said, I care less about Lloyd Austin being the defense secretary. I care more about sort of broad opportunity so that 10, 20 years from now, it's actually irrelevant. And that there is a large body of talent that can fill any one of a number of jobs, not just across national security, but elsewhere. Michael, I want to get your sense on sort of the highs, the lows, winners. I suspect I know some of them, full disclosure, right, are friends when they come to members of Congress and in senior positions, both in government as well as out. But sort of what's your sense on what jumped out at you and what might have been actually the underreported story of the year?
So I think one of the underreported stories, and I think one of the lows, is that, you know, the great deal maker in the White House is not such a great deal maker.
Didn't we know that, though, in 2016, for all of us who were from New York City, who knew that actually he's somewhat mafiosi-like and always manages, you know what I mean? He doesn't give the order to have somebody shot. He goes, I don't know. All I told Michael was, I wish somebody would rid me of this meddlesome priest. I don't understand why anybody is surprised at seeing any of this, right? But anyway, go on.
Thank you. And, you know, of course, you know, inside the Beltway, folks like us don't like it when people outside the Beltway come in and try and tell us our business, because it's not as easy as it looks. And, you know, it's very easy to destroy, very hard to create. And of course, there is no new Iran deal that was promised, and we're in a worse situation with Iran than we would have been otherwise. There is no new deal with North Korea. We broke our pact with the Kurds by pulling out of Syria. There is no grand new deal with China, despite all the rhetoric. And, you know, as we talked about earlier in the show, will we get, you know, just the basic functionings of government taken care of before the end of his term? But I think there's a lot of people that deserve, you know, a shout out for the things that they've done during this year. And I think there's a mix of both Democrats and Republicans. One, I think, you know, in light of what's going on now with the president trying to attack the fundamentals of our democracy and attacking and alleging voter fraud, I think there are some Republicans like the governor of Georgia and the secretary of state of Georgia who deserve a lot of credit for standing up and doing it at great personal risk, that they've had to get personal security to protect them because they are abiding by their oath and not caving into the president's demands. Same goes true for the folks in Michigan and Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Wisconsin. I think people like Adam Schiff, I mean, we forgot we began this year with an impeachment, I think showed incredible courage and discipline to see that process through, knowing where it would probably end up. And again, a great personal sacrifice to himself. He had to have the security detail follow him and his family wherever they went. And then, you know, some other Republicans in the House, and Senate who had the courage to stand up to the president. We see folks who are not running for re-election stand up to the president because they've got nothing to lose. But these are folks with things to lose. Folks like Adam Kinzinger, who is in the Air Force Reserve, who's on the Foreign Affairs Committee, has regularly stood up to the president and told him to enough, enough's enough. Same with Mitt Romney over in the Senate. And I think folks like that deserve a lot of credit because there's too many people in the House and the Senate that will say and do anything because they just want to be here. And at the end of the day, I don't understand how the job is rewarding to them. And folks that exhibit courage should get credit when they do so.
And also, right, those members who did not switch parties and decided to stay in there. But again, there's everybody who wished that everybody was, especially on the Republican side, was more forceful in condemning the president when he should be condemned. Because I have to say, there was quite a lot of whataboutism as opposed to saying, no, that's simply wrong. Gordon, you want to go and you have to go, but just wanted to give you one word before you take off. Because I do think one thing the president does deserve credit on is getting tougher on China in a necessary, which was a necessary thing to do. He has not done it the right way. But I think that that's the one credit that I will give the president that he deserves some credit for. Go ahead, Gordon.
Just two really brief points. One, what you've just underlined, which is regardless of what he did in Afghanistan, China, or anyone else, this is not a strategic thinker. There's been no strategic underpinning. Withdrawals of forces have had no strategic rationale. So we've lacked strategy. But the second point I want to make, and just in departing, is that if we're going to be an example to anybody else anywhere in the world of a democracy, we've got a lot of work to do here at home before we can even stand at the table, let alone at the head of the table, and say anybody ought to do what we do and not just what we say. So happy holidays to everybody.
Gordon, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Have a great holiday. Looking forward to having you back on next week as we look ahead into 2021. Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Byron, what were some of the surprises in 2020? I mean, we can say that we were surprised by the pandemic. We were surprised by the, you know, U.S. abject lack of being able to control it, right? I mean, at a time when we're talking about competition with China, you know, there's no way you're competing with China if you can't rein in this deadly pandemic at home and, in fact, do everything to fuel it that made it worse in places like Tennessee and elsewhere in the country. What were some of the things that you just think?
Well, I think I'll throw two more on the table. The fact that we didn't have a war. I mean, we really walked up. You could say this is true about 2019 as well, but I think particularly vis-a-vis Iran, you know, we really kind of walked up to the edge of the abyss in a couple of occasions. And I think that's a, you know, a positive surprise in a way that there's still been pressure on Iran, but we didn't go over the edge.
We still have time. We still have time.
That's true. Yeah. We've got, you know, 7 days left. I think another one might be that we've talked a lot about Trump, but I think in general, it's, and I think this is more of a consensus view, it's not been a good year for populist leaders in the way that they've handled the pandemic. I look at the UK, Brazil, even Putin and Russia, I think that's going to be a story that's going to play through. It kind of goes back to Gordon's comment about government and the value and Dove's comments on the civil service, that there's value to having a competent, educated, well-informed, knowledgeable civil service and a leadership that believes in science, that believes in not, you know, signing up to the latest quack theory will work or what won't work. And I think populism probably took it on the chin this year. But again, I think that's a consensus view. That's something a lot of people recognize.
I think it's worthwhile, right? I mean, you were talking about expertise. Hondo Gertz, right? And each of the acquisition executives give Hondo a shout out because he was so communicative with reporters, talking about how, despite the pandemic, how we can leverage government to actually do a better job, right? How can we certify ships faster and get them into the fleet? How can we streamline processes that were too bulky? How can we use this generational change while working in a remote and distributed way to be able to deliver better effects? You know, Bruce Jetty did that in the Army. Mark Lewis, you know, from the standpoint of technology at the department. Will Roper talking, you know, about the prototype effort to get NGAD, a flying prototype out there to demonstrate some of the technology, right? So these are all expert people who are managing to drive their organizations to do great things. And as our producer Chris Cervello likes to point out, right, when about war with Iran, never talk about a no hitter in the eighth inning, right? It always tends to go badly. We can keep our fingers crossed though.
The ninth inning, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's closer to the ninth inning, but still, it ain't over until it's over, as the legendary Yogi Berra would say. Dov, let me quickly ask you, you know, we are talking about Iran, obviously a very, very high profile transit. United States Navy doesn't like to discuss what its submarines are doing. The USS Georgia, the SSGN, the cruise missile submarine that can carry 154 Tomahawks, transited on the surface through the Strait of Hormuz, being escorted by Port Royal, a guided missile cruiser. We had an Israeli submarine transit the Suez Canal and dive immediately on getting into the Red Sea. Israeli submarines have been in the neighborhood before, and this is all happening as the Israeli government collapses. Netanyahu looking to avoid going to jail, as some people would say, right? I mean, every tactic seems to be focused on that, and he certainly hopes Likud's going to win. Talk to us a little bit about, briefly, the dynamic situation we see with Iran. I know that the effect is to try to deter, but there are other people who say this is pre-positioning of assets as well. Talk to us a little bit about what these movements mean and what the collapse of the government in Israel will mean.
Okay, a couple of points about surprises. One, which was a good one, that the Trump administration, however little they may have been involved in this, pulled off a major change in the Middle East that I think will have long-lasting ramifications, and certainly got the attention of Iran. And that, of course, is Israel's agreement now with four different Arab countries to go essentially official. A disappointment, by the way, was for all the fanfare about what we were going to do in Venezuela, we wound up doing nothing. And that's something that's very important. It's a message to people who care about democracy that this administration talked a lot about getting rid of the dictator down there and supporting Guaido, and nothing happened. On your question itself, look, this is the anniversary of the killing of the head of the Quds force. The Qasem Iranians Soleimani. Have vowed Soleimani, exactly, and the Iranians have vowed revenge. They have done very little, if nothing, actually, over the year. So everybody expected something, and this was a message to them: don't even think about it. And that's very, very important. And the fact that it wasn't just an American ship going through there, but a coordinated effort, multiple countries, that's an even stronger message to the Iranians. As far as the Israeli election is concerned, Netanyahu didn't want an election. Three people from his own party defected by hiding out in a parking lot, actually, until the vote, so that nobody could find them and force them to vote for the government. When the vote was called, they came into the chamber and voted him down. But at the end of the day, the Israeli public is naturally for Netanyahu. And I wouldn't be surprised if the guy figures out how to evade and avoid, once again, any kind of real prosecution. Gets himself reelected and maybe even has enough of a majority in parliament to allow him to avoid all of this legal stuff entirely. The nature of the Israeli population has changed sufficiently, and people who think back to the movie of Exodus or anything like that have a really wrong impression of what Israel's about these days.
I think that everybody can look at the Abraham Accords as something that is strategic and important, but doesn't get to the underlying issue of an Israeli-Palestinian two-state solution, right? I mean, I think that that's the criticism. It's very, very good strategically for Israel. It's great for the nations in the region that want to deter Iran. It's not so good about the central issue about whether or not it'll be a two-state solution or just a one-state solution. And I think that that is, if I can say, a concern that that's had by some. I should also point out that USS Georgia does have a SEAL delivery capability that makes it a little bit unique. Michael?
Let me just add, on this two-state solution, essentially, if the Israelis want a one-state solution, they're going to have the kind of thing that happened this week, which wasn't reported very widely, where a mother of six went out running. She was on the West Bank, and she was apparently raped, tortured, and killed. That's going to continue until you separate these sides. And the Israelis seem to be blind to it.
It's certainly a very important event and something that does fall into the category of stuff that should have maybe been reported or gets lost at a time when everybody is focused on a couple of central stories, which is COVID and Trump. Michael, very, very quickly, get your sense on sort of the surprise story that you think should have gotten a little bit more attention than didn't.
Well, since I'm the political guy on the call, I'll say the thing that surprised me and really disappointed me the most is really the lack of vision for both political parties. You know, parties are supposed to be about policies and ideas and ideals. And I understand, you know, Biden had to take a very safe route to really preach a return to normalcy and decency. But at the same time, it's not clear what both parties are really about. And on the Republican side, it was just the final step into a cult of personality when at the convention, there was no platform, just a pledge of loyalty to Trump. And when Trump would be asked, even by friendly audiences, what his plan was for the next 4 years, he could not answer the question. And you have a lot of Trump defenders out there say, well, I may not like his behavior, his attitude, but I support his policies. And what are those policies? And I think, again, it dovetails into, you know, his handling of the coronavirus is a policy. And we've not only, you know, seem to have abandoned truth, but we've also abandoned science as well. And at a time where the president had a chance to step up and lead the country and comfort the country, he not only missed that chance, he purposely shunned that chance.
And I think that's why it was so powerful to hear from Joe Biden a couple of days ago, or yesterday, I think it was, where he said that actually our darkest days are ahead of us. To sort of gird the country for that. Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a great holiday, a Merry Christmas, and looking forward to having you guys back on again so that we can look ahead to 2021 and what we think the big stories are. Thanks again.
Thank you, Vago, and happy holidays.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And just want to wish our audience a very happy holiday, a very Merry Christmas, and we'll see you again next week.